Well, hello, my friends, and welcome to another episode of Little Cabin Knits. This is episode 69, Somatic Memories. I'm your host, Emily. My pronouns are she, her. I am a mental health therapist, and this podcast is all about crafting adventures, my life adventures here in the wilds of Alaska, my life as a mental health therapist, whether I'm working as a professional in the field or just general knowledge, and just my life as a new mom of a one-year-old. Yes, he is now one. My podcast has been on the air for 4 years now, so that is a big milestone for me, and I'm really excited about it, and I want to thank you all for joining me on this journey. So go ahead and grab a cup of your choice, do some chores, go ahead and lay back on your bed and just relax or cuddle or knit or craft, whatever, as we come along and I tell you more about my crafting life and what are somatic memories. Well, hello, my friends. Emily here. I have been trying to record an episode for a couple weeks now, and I am just not finding the time. We are having a lot of Watson, as in my dog, emergencies. He's 15 years old. He's having a hard time. And then just life as a mom, and I've also been applying and interviewing for quite a few job positions that would allow me to work remotely as a counselor and still maintain my own schedule and everything like that. So I've been working really hard on those things. So this morning, it's a Saturday morning, it's raining out, and my sister and her daughters, so my nieces, and I are about to meet up to go garage sailing. And so I'm driving over to my mom's house, and we're going to meet up and head on out. But it's been a while since I sat down, and so I just thought maybe I would, the sound quality won't be great. I don't have my mic in front of me. I'm using my, you know, those earbud things. So the sound quality won't be great. But I just thought I would record kind of naturally when I have time over the next couple days, just a segment at a time, just so I can finally get an episode out and talk about the things that has been on my mind. So a little bit around the fire about what's been happening in our lives. So my son, Jimmy, turned 1 year old. It was a wonderful family event. We didn't have any friends over or anything like that because I just, you know how things are with all of the different concerns, health concerns that are out there. And especially with RSV right now, I just didn't want to take any chances. So we just had a family gathering, and it was really lovely. We got some pictures and my parents' garden of us three. I spent days preparing for his birthday party. I researched out smash cakes to the nth degree because I was determined to do a cake for Jimmy that did not have any sugar but also tasted good. So I consulted with a couple friends as well who had done smash cakes in the past, and, you know, there's this consensus, either it tastes really good without the sugar or it tastes really bad. And it also depends on who you ask. Like, some of my health nut friends, they were all like, yeah, no sugars, no problem. You just add applesauce or bananas and it tastes great. And other friends who are normal eaters like myself were like, no, that's not going to cut it. But I ended up doing a smash cake. I made my own oat flour, and I smashed in some bananas. It was a little bit like making an unleavened banana bread. And so in that sense, I was pretty darn happy with the results. The thing that I was not happy with was the frosting. I tried making frosting 7 different ways. I think that's an exaggeration. I think I did 4 different recipes, and every one was a fail. And because I was determined again to do no sugar. So finally I was over at my mom's house preparing on the day of, and my niece came over, who is a really good amateur baker, like seriously top notch. And she said, well, I'll just figure out a recipe. And so I have no idea what my niece did, but she used a teensy bit of sugar, maple syrup for sure. I know we didn't use honey because there's this thing about not using honey with kiddos before they're 2 years old. There's a thing about everything, my friends, about everybody has a different opinion, and boy howdy, do they let you know about their differing opinions about raising your own child. It's getting ridiculous. But, and we just, so we got the frosting done just in time, and I frosted it. It didn't look the greatest, because I'm not a great baker, which also means I'm not great at frosting cakes. But we presented it to Jimmy, and he at first didn't know what to do with it, because he's just like, Mommy doesn't let me just smash through food normally. I mean, I know until about 1 year old, food is about playing and exploring texture. But Jimmy, because he's a preemie baby, he learns at a different pace. And he, you know, one of the things that I was most concerned of is that he's getting the nutrients from the food more than he's playing. And now I'm at the stage where I can relax. He's 1 year old. I feel like I can relax. And now he's at the stage where he's playing a lot more with food. And he is making messes galore, let me tell you. But the day of his birthday, I had to show him how to be messy with his cake. It was really fun. The family thought it was hilarious. There's lots of laughter. And he got some sweet clothes from his one pair of grandparents, and my sisters and my brother, they all gave him different little things. My brothers, I should say. And I got him toys from our secondhand store on my trade account. And I got him one item. Jeremy and I each got him one new item. So Jeremy got him a toy construction, like, excavator type thing. I don't know. But Jimmy thinks it's hilarious. He loves the sounds that it makes. And I got him this little wooden block that has carrots, wooden carrots inside. And that has turned out to be his favorite toy. He loves to pick the carrots out of the wooden block and either throw them across the room and laugh as mommy goes and runs and picks them up and brings them back. Or he likes to chew on them. And just in this last week, he started figuring out that he can pull the carrots out and put them back in. Isn't that amazing? So we've just been having a great time, spending lots of time with family, lots of time with both Jeremy's parents, who just got back from their, from their winter quarters down in the South, and my parents as well. On the Watson front, he's not doing the greatest. I did have to take him to the emergency room, and he had to stay overnight because we thought he was in ketosis again. Turns out he was not, but at the same time, he's not doing good. The insulin is having a hard time working on him, and so they suspect what he has is Cushing's, so which is also an autoimmune disease. And Cushing works exactly opposite to, this is what the vet said, I haven't completely done enough research to truly understand it myself. The Cushing's, I guess, works opposite to the diabetes, and thus making it, preventing the insulin from getting to where it's needed. So they recommended we do the Cushing's test and do the medication. And then I talked to my vet, and my vet was saying, no, it's just time to let him go because you don't understand how difficult managing Cushing's and diagnosing and getting and dialing in the dosage of Cushing's is. At one point, she even said something along the lines of, if you get the wrong dosage of the medicine, it could kill him. So I've got, and then another vet at the pet emergency was saying something completely opposite from these two. And so I was just completely in a tizzy for about 24 hours, just crying nonstop. One second I was elated, thinking that, Watson was going to be just fine. And the next second I'm being told that I need to let him go, as in put him down. I am very much against putting down animals. I feel that it's a disrespect to the love and support that they've given us. Now, that is all relative. If Watson's life was really, really bad off, as in he couldn't move, couldn't do anything, was soiling himself as he lay there, I would probably think differently. He's not there yet. He still has spunk and life in him, and he enjoys being with the family. And even when he's sick, all he wants is to be with us. And to my way of thinking, if there is some way that I can support my animal and have him live a healthy enough life, then it's worth it to me. At the same time, the Cushing's testing and diagnosis and medication is not cheap, and we can't afford it. We actually maxed out our credit card, the one credit card that we have. I'm very much against credit lines, and we've only had a credit card for emergency purposes. So we've used it for medical bills for the vet and for us. That's it. And now it's maxed out. So that should tell you something about our medical industry. But the emergency people told me that there are rescues here in Alaska that will help us and possibly even pay for all of the testing and maybe even the medications. I just need to call them and beg for help. And I am totally fine with begging. I have no qualms. This morning over breakfast, my husband was asking me about how I felt about receiving charity if we were to ask for help for Watson. And I said, I'm perfectly fine with it because here's the thing. My entire career has been about helping the disenfranchised, the people who are marginalized, the people who have no money. I've worked for very little pay to in order to work in this sector and to help and to be of help to these people. And now I'm the one in need of help. My family's the one in need of help, and I'm okay with asking for help when it's that time. I think that it's hubris in me to say that I can make it on my own, that I'm not an island. I can't make this on my own. I can be very ingenious and find ways to bridge the gaps in our income, like I'm doing right now. But what I can't do is pull a miracle out of thin air. And right now, what we need for Watson is a miracle. And so that means I need to ask for help, and I'm okay with that. I think that kind of took my husband aback. He's always been, I'm sorry, I just can't get rid of this frog in my throat. He's always been of the mentality that, you just make do. You don't ask for help. You just make do it on your own. And if that means you can't have the necessities of life, I guess that's what it means. And I told him, no, like if I was asking for a luxury trip or even a trip period, then I would feel guilty, right? Or if I was asking for a new car when my car works, I mean, it's not a great car, but it works, it runs. then I would feel guilty. I'm not asking for anything for myself. I'm asking for help to save our dog and to help him be healthy. And so I think that really changed his mindset about what was going on. So we'll see how things go from here. I'm tired of crying. I feel like I've cried out, and now I'm in the mode of I have a purpose. I'm going to do everything I can to make my dog healthy and happy. But there was about a day or 24 hours there, 36 hours where I remember at one point I was walking across my living room. I had just gotten off the phone with one of the vets, And I was walking across the living room to go pick up Jimmy, and I just stumbled and fell to my knees, just absolutely sobbing, heart-rending sobs. And my little Jimmy crawled across the floor and was patting my head and trying to wiggle underneath my burrowed shoulder so he could cuddle with me because he knew something was wrong. And yeah. There's a reason why. Like, there's such a connection. Watson came into my life when I was in my 20s, and I was very lonely at the time that he came in my life. And he filled, I was feeling the ache of not having my own family. All my friends had married and had and were having children, and were all blissfully happy, and I was feeling very much the lack thereof. And Watson just appeared in my life. I randomly went to the pound one day, and I just saw him cowering in a corner, covered in dried blood, because he was pretty much feral. Like, nobody could get near him, and he was on the docket to go to be put down. And somehow or other, I convinced them to allow me to try and make a connection with him. And as soon as I got near Watson, I just sat on the ground, and Watson just came out of his darkened corner, and he crawled into my lap, and I was just a goner from that moment on. And it's been a long, hard road, but Watson has been with me through the darkest days of my life, and also through the brightest and most joyful, full of love days of my life. And he has been a constant companion, always there for love and support in his quiet, joyful way. And I am going to do everything I can to make his last years on this earth as wonderful as possible. So I'll get off my soapbox for now. But it's been a couple weeks of a lot of emotions, both the highs and the lows. But that, my friends, is around the fire. On the couch. I am continuing the work on my Battenberg blanket that I am crocheting up for my parents. I'm going in fits and starts at the moment. I've gone through three skeins of yarn. I'm almost done with my fourth skein, which is a yellow. Some days I'm really into it and I will crochet like 10 squares. At least it seems like to me. And other days I just can't do it. I was in one of those days a couple weeks, no, not even a couple weeks, yeah, a week ago. I think it was last Sunday. And I just couldn't handle it anymore. I love to crochet. It's a brand new hobby for me. It's very interesting and engaging, and but it's not necessarily comforting to me like knitting is, and I just could not handle it anymore. So I put on my wrist stabilizer and I put on one of my compression sleeves, and I broke out my airiest, lightest, as in weight-wise, project that also didn't require me to have great tension. And that turned out to be Smooth Sailor by Martina Behm, or Behm. I never can say her last name right. She's a German designer. And I've always loved her designs in the fact that she has extremely, amazingly technical and ingenious constructions of her designs. Now, her designs are oftentimes garter stitch, or stocking net stitch in the round, and that can be really boring for a lot of people. But when you think about the construction that goes on, either at the beginning or the end of the piece, it's well worth the effort. And I had cast on Smooth Sailor, I want to say back in January, because I found the construction just fascinated me. And the beginning of the, so Smooth Sailor is sort of a shrug, sort of a poncho, sort of a shawl, sort of a pullover sweater, a cowl. It can be everything. And I just was fascinated by it, and it I don't think it's gotten the attention that it deserves. And so I cast it on using Knit Picks alpaca in the lace weight, and the beginning of the pattern was about to break my brain. It's a construction like I've never had before, ever, ever, ever. And I am surprised that I pulled it off. You start at the shoulders with the armholes and you construct them. Sounds really odd to say this, but but you construct them separately and yet together at the same time. I don't know how to explain it. You have to go and download it and try it for yourself. Martina does have videos on how to do this, but you have to have the pattern. It's a private account. The pattern provides you with a code so that you can watch the videos and stuff. And she's very smart in that way because otherwise, I have a feeling people would steal a lot of her techniques that she's worked very hard to develop on her own and to make up on her own. I have never seen anything constructed like this ever in my life. She is genius personified. She is a knitting engineer. But I had gotten to the point on my Smooth Sailor back in January where I got past all the really technical bits, the hard bits, the breaking my brain bits. And then my hands had gotten so bad that I literally couldn't even hold the needles. So I set it aside. And this last Sunday, I picked it up again. And yes, I have to wear my wrist stabilizer and my compression sleeve. And on my right hand arm, I have to wear my elbow brace. But I was able to knit on it. And I took it to my knitting group and I was knitting on it. And oh, and it's and it looks really funny on the needles because it's scrunched up in odd ways. And it's but you're knitting it in the round. I'm on the part where you're knitting it in the round all the way down to the end, and you can choose at the end to put on the ruffled edging, and I think I'm gonna do ruffles because ruffles are just sweet and comforting and make you feel girly and light as a feather at the same time. So yeah, I think I'm gonna do the ruffles. But I have four skeins or five skeins actually of Alpaca Cloud, and I think there's 440 yards in each. And I'm just going to knit the body until I've got one skein left and reserve that last skein for the ruffled edge. I think that's how it goes. I'm going to triple check the pattern. I might need a little more than one skein. But at Knit Group, it looked really weird. It kind of looked like I had a snake bunched up in my lap that I was trying to untangle. And so everybody was like, "What is that?" And so I was showing them off, and they were just absolutely fascinated. I know one of my knitting friends is very interested in casting that on. And I did tell her, like, it could be boring for somebody who has the normal use of their hands. For me, this lightweight lace knitting on very loose gauge. I'm knitting it on US 6 needles. Is perfect. It doesn't weigh anything in my hand, so it's not fatiguing my arms to hold this up. I'm not worried about my gauge. In fact, I kind of feel like this is going to tell a beautiful story about my arm healing journey in the end. And I want to embrace the wonky gauge that is coming forth out of this, and I'm okay, I'm totally okay with that now. But for somebody who has the normal use of their hands, they might find once you get past the brain breaking beginning construction, they might find it boring to knit on. And so I just gave her that fair warning, and I'll provide that for you too. This is absolutely perfect knitting once you get past the front, the front end of the pattern. This is perfect knitting if I was watching like a foreign film in which I was reading the captions that were the translations. This would be perfect for that. Or something that I was completely enthralled with as far as watching on TV when you didn't have to look at your hands. This would be the project that I would choose for that. For me, I'm listening to a lot of podcasts. I'm listening to a lot of audiobooks. I am sometimes knitting on it while I watch TV, but most of the time it's just so healing for me. I actually most of the time when I'm knitting on this, I find that I'm just sitting in quiet and just knitting in quiet because the joy of having needles in my hands is so overwhelmingly comforting that I need nothing else. And so yeah, there's nothing like your first love. Now, if I had learned to crochet first, I think I would be the exact opposite. If I couldn't crochet right now, I think I'd be aching to crochet. There's a new to me YouTube channel called I Am Sarah. I think that's the name of it. She is a Dutch crocheter and knitter, and I've been enjoying hers. She does, I think she puts out like 4 episodes a week on YouTube, 2 in English and 2 in Dutch. But I've watched 2 episodes of hers now, and she is very much a crocheter. And she, and actually, that's how I came across her, is because I think the episode of something like I Love to Crochet or something like that came up on my YouTube, you might be interested in feed. And the way she talks about crochet is the way I feel, and probably I'm coming across right now about knitting. I really, really enjoyed her 2 episodes that I've watched in the past couple weeks. They've been really soothing, on me, and she's not pushing. I don't want to say that we as podcasters and YouTubers push different yarns, but there are some days where I feel like I'm watching a YouTube channel and they're knitting with very expensive yarn and they're talking about all of the independent dyers that they're purchasing from and that they're going to make like entire sweaters or entire blankets out of independently dyed DK weight yarn. Like, who can afford that? My goodness. And I look at that and I do sometimes feel, yeah, probably a little jealous if I'll admit it. And my station in life has changed dramatically. I don't have the extra funds to buy any yarn. In fact, I used a coupon last week so that I could go to Joann's and get 50% off a $4.50 skein of scrubby yarn. I think it's Lion Brand. No, it's Red Heart Scrubby. Because my mother-in-law asked me if I would crochet her up some kitchen scrubbies. And the only way I could do it is if I had used the coupon. And even then, I think at the time I had $18 in my bank account. And I was like, all right, I'm going to sacrifice $2 of this so that I can get the scrubby yarn and crochet this up for my mother-in-law because she does so much for us and she deserves it. And I'm going to work on it. Now, that saying, scrubby dishcloths are not on the couch right now because I've started and ripped out about 4 or 5 different patterns. I am having a really hard time finding a pattern that makes sense. Actually, you know what I think it is? I think it's the yarn. The yarn is extremely hard to read, and I get lost very quickly in the crochet. Like, I can't find the stitches in the crochet. So I keep having to rip everything out. I'm hoping that I'll get the hang of this within the next week and I'll be like, things will just click and I'll be able to bang out at least 4 or 5 scrubbies for her. I'd like to do some for my house as well. 'Cause I do greatly enjoy hand, I've got a whole basket full of hand knit washcloths that are only for use. They don't ever see soap on them. My husband and I only use them to wash our faces, and we never use like astringent soap or anything on our faces. And so we just use these
hand knit washcloths that I then also hand wash to wash our faces with. And I'd like to do something like that for the kitchen, only something that's of sturdier stuff that I feel is hardier, will hold up better. So yeah, I could use kitchen cotton, but I don't think my hands could handle kitchen cotton right now. So yeah, we'll see. We'll see what I come up with. But that, my friends, is on the couch. Pardon me. Oh my. I don't know why I can't get rid of this cough. It must just be the weather, the rain and the chilly morning. I think it's about 49 degrees out. I think it's maybe 45. I should check. I don't know if this will continue recording while I check. 49 degrees. Yeah, exactly what I thought. And it looks like the high today is maybe going to be 55. And it is June 10th. So we've had some fun weather. But this segment is not about that. This segment is on the shelf. I have one, to me, epic on the shelf project, and that is the four color, let's see, crochet four color baby sweater by Daisy Farm Crafts. And this is a free pattern. You can watch the tutorial of it from start to finish on Daisy Farm Crafts' YouTube channel, which is where I first came across it. She does have the pattern for free on her website. Her website is one of those ones that has a bajillion ads on there. I don't know how these people, I don't know how these people get traffic to their websites, because I get so frustrated when I go to those websites or those blogs, what I think are blogs, and they turn out to be these websites where people have, like, every third sentence there's a advertisement, and then there's advertisements just popping up right in front of your face as you're trying to read, and then there at the corner at the very bottom there's a video advertisement going on. It drives me crazy. But she does have that website, but and the pattern is free on that website, and I did go there and I was able to get that, and I was able to crochet up Jimmy a sweater for him. It's in Knit Picks Brava DK. No, Knit Picks Brava worsted, sorry. And that means it's acrylic. And I knit it in Tide Pool. I knit it in orange. And what was the third color? Brown. I forgot brown. And I don't remember what the colorway names are of the orange and the brown off the top of my head, but it's obvious when you go to their website if you choose to pick it out. It's an interesting color combination. It very much gives off 70s vibes, but Jimmy rocks it pretty darn well. I followed her directions to a T, and the sweater is a little bit big. I thought I was knitting it to a size. She doesn't exactly say on there, cast on this many crochet chains, and in the end, you'll have a sweater for a 1-year-old or a 6-month-old. No, what she does is she says, well, let's just see what happens if we crochet it and worsted weight and go up 2 needles or 2 crochet hooks. That's really what I did. It was just an experiment. I did follow what she did said, and I was hopeful that it was going to fit him as a 1-year-old, but at the same time, I'm really glad that it's a little bit big on him. He'll be able to wear it this entire chilly summer, especially when we go camping next weekend. And then for Father's Day and Juneteenth, and we're also doing a knit camp out, which I totally forgot to talk about. And see, so many things have happened. My goodness. I'm hosting a 1-day knitting camp out event next weekend here in Alaska for Alaskan knitters and crocheters and weavers and sewers and yes, and anybody who wants to come. So anyway, he'll be able to wear that camping, and he'll be able to wear it till he's at least 18 months old, if not 2 years old. I'd be honestly surprised if he couldn't wear it to then. Right now, the sleeves are a little long on him, so I have to roll them up a bit, but that just makes him look even cuter. So, and this was a great project. This was the second time I had done ribbing using crochet. The first time was when I did his hat. Last episode, I talked about his hat that I finished, and I did crochet ribbing on that. And so I was a lot better prepared for the ribbing crocheting technique for this sweater. Essentially, what it is you knit through the front post, and then you knit through the back post, front post, back post. And I haven't figuring out what all that means was quite interesting for me. But I'm learning so many things when it comes to crochet. It's amazing to me. I always thought in my head that crochet was, I'll be honest, a simple craft. Yeah, that makes me look bad, and I'm gonna own that. Now that I'm doing it and exploring all the different things that are out there, and the different techniques, the different stitches and knots out there, I'm like, holy crap, this is amazing. Now I want to do things like macrame. I want to crochet myself a sweater. Oh my gosh, have you guys looked at the amount of yarn needed to crochet a sweater, an adult size sweater? It's insane. So I've gone through my stash and I have one DK weight sweater quantity that I could probably eke out a size for me. In crocheting now. And that's because I have lost about 40 pounds, maybe almost 50 pounds in the last year. I think I'm down to 142, I think it is. I'm at 142. I think that's what I'm at. I'll have to double check at my parents' house again, but if I was 50 pounds heavier, I could not I do I would not have sweater's quantity of yarn in my stash. So for my size, which I'm still going to choose to probably do a large to an extra large of crochet, I would need about 2300 to 2600 yards of DK weight. DK weight, my friends. So I have that. And I have one sweater's quantity of fingering weight that I think will get me a sweater. Now, here's the thing. I want to knit the granny, okay, you guys have all seen the granny stitch blanket, right? I want to knit crochet a granny stitch sweater out of fingering weight. Not DK weight, not worsted weight, fingering weight. Finding a sweater pattern that does fingering weight, granny stitch sweater has been impossible. There's lots of DK weight. Granny stitch sweaters. Fingering weight is just ridiculously hard. If any of you have any suggestions on fingering weight, granny stitch sweaters, and it could also be a sorry, I've lost the name of it right now. Sweater pullover. Cardigan! That's the word. Sorry, that got really loud. Cardigan. It could also be a cardigan because I think that would be really cute too. But I'm really determined that my first sweater I would like to be a fingering weight and granny stitch because I just love it so much. Also, I think it'd be really, really, really cute to do a fingering weight granny stitch sweater out of all of my different scraps. Wouldn't that be amazing? Oh my gosh, I love that idea. You know, one thing I haven't done yet is I literally have yet to do a granny stitch square. And I think that would also be really great if I could do a really crazy granny stitch square cardigan or pullover in fingering weight. I think that would just make my life complete to have the craziest sweater colors, and I wouldn't even care. I would just reach blindly into my scrap bin and pull out whatever it was, and I would just go with it and rock it. I would love to do that. Yeah. But there's, for some odd reason, practically every sweater I come across, if that it's a pattern, It's all DK weight for crochet. And to me, that just seems like it would be too bulky, especially for the granny stitch. It just seems way too bulky. I just can't wrap my mind around that I would like the fabric that would result from that. Maybe what it is I need to just give it a whirl and see how I like the fabric and then decide from there instead of just deciding willy-nilly that I wouldn't like the density and the suppleness or the stiffness versus the stiffness of the fabric. I think that's what I need to do. But all that rambling to say that one sweater, a four color stripe sweater for Jimmy is complete and he's been wearing it, if not every day, every other day since we completed it. I've had to wash it twice, which by the way, I have been putting that sweater in just with a regular load on regular cycle. Granted, I do a cold tap for most of my cycles with in my washing machine. And the yarn is getting softer and softer, but it's not getting fuzzier. It's amazing how Knitpix has come up with this acrylic yarn. It's not your mother's acrylic yarn. That is for darn sure. Like, you know, that plasticky feeling yarn that we had when we were little back in the 80s and stuff. Yeah, it's not that kind of yarn at all. So I highly recommend it. And there she goes recommending yarn after she just said that she gets frustrated when people recommend yarn. But I'm recommending economic yarn. So my conscience is assuaged. Assuaged? No, assuaged. Assuaged? Assuaged. Yes, that's the word. But that it's on the shelf. Personal skill set. This past month, I've cried an ocean of tears. Tears of fear, of physical pain, emotional pain, loneliness, anxiety, frustration, confusion, and even joyful tears. Each time I cried, I wondered why this moment. Now, we're talking about before everything happened with Watson, mind you, okay? Why is this experience so much overwhelming that my psyche says tears are the correct response? What is happening internally? I cried in the shower. I wailed many days in the shower because I didn't want to cry in front of my husband or my son. And I didn't want them to ever think that I was crying because of them, because that's not what was happening. I knew that much. Then, the morning of Jimmy's first birthday, I was in the shower and I was crying again. And I was wailing. And Jimmy was in his crib asleep, and so I was safe to let the tears fall. I was crying so much that I was having trouble breathing. And that's when it hit me. That breathing part is what really got everything connected together. These past few weeks, my body was remembering the trauma of my hospital stay and the birth of my son. Now, I say trauma because that's really what it was. Even the most beautiful births are still traumatic to our bodies. And mine was pretty dramatic. I had been hospitalized for 2 weeks, then I was in induced labor for 72 hours, and then at 3 a.m. they told me they needed to go in for an emergency C-section, and within the hour I was in on the operating table having the worst panic attack of my entire life. Now, I used to have panic attacks when I first left my ex-husband because I was always afraid I was going to get hurt. Leaving an abused a partner is the most dangerous time for a woman or a man who is leaving an abused relationship because that could be the time in which the worst of the worst happens. And I would have panic attacks. I would sleep in my car in random alleys because I was afraid that he would track me down. And This here I was on the operating table a year ago, having my son, the one thing that I wanted most in this life, and I was having the worst panic attack of my life. And when, in the midst of that panic attack, they held Jimmy up over the curtain, I saw his face, and the one thing that went through my mind was, that's not my son. And then that made my panic attack and my tears fall even harder. They had a hard time, you know, calming me down. The only person that could calm me down was my husband. And then the next thing you know, they were sewing me back up really fast so they could get me out of there and back into the recovery room. Now, traumatic events like this, and like the ones that had happened in my past before this, they leave not only an emotional impact, they not only leave memories of those events, but your body physically remembers those. And when something triggers them that your body is remembering that, again, we call those somatic experiences. So what had been happening to me over the last couple weeks leading up to Jimmy's first birthday was my body was remembering the trauma that I had gone through. But my memories were not remembering, if that makes sense. I had blocked those out because all I want now is to just revel in the joy that is my son and being a mother. Like, that's all I want. I don't want to remember the health scares and how frightened I was and the panic attacks and all of the health complications that came before, during, and after the birth. I don't want to remember all those things. And so, yeah, as a natural response, I have blocked them out for the most part. But my body remembers, and that is called somatic memories. You know, 1 in 4 women feel trauma surrounding the birth of their child. And most of women will experience flashbacks. And these things we term as post-traumatic stress disorder. A lot of times we also put this under the umbrella of postnatal, oh my gosh, I lost the name of it, depression after the birth. See, I lost the name. I'm sorry, guys. I lost the name. Sometimes I feel very stupid as a therapist because sometimes I just completely blank on names and terms. Postnatal. I'm just going to call it postnatal depression for now. So 1 in 4 women experience trauma during the birth of their children. And that's not because we don't love them. And it's not because we don't want them. It's because the actual experience of having birth, of giving birth, it's traumatic. The things you put your bodies through, and we put our bodies through. Oh my goodness. But in this moment, in the shower, as everything came together and I was hyperventilating, I wasn't technically having a panic attack, but I was hyperventilating and I had to sit down in the shower and really concentrate on my breathing and the feel of the shower, the water falling on my head to calm myself down and recenter myself, reground myself, reorient myself. That piecing of the puzzle, it empowered me. Because I made the connection, I understood what was going on. And because while the emotional and physical flashbacks were scary, these were also natural reactions to the trauma that my body had experienced and my body's way of protecting itself against a perceived possible harm in the future. This is a very natural response. If you have PTSD, this is a natural response of your body trying to protect you from repeating a traumatic experience again. Okay. So they'll give you warnings like, don't go to this area of town. Don't do this behavior. Don't say this thing. Don't make a connection with this type of person, that kind of thing. They're going to give you warnings because your body and your memories make those connections that oftentimes consciously we aren't able to do, and they want to protect us, your conscious mind, from making not a mistake, but walking into harm again. So these painful memories are stored in the body. So those are somatic memories. So when an experience, like a particular set of circumstances or unresolved events from your past, when they shatter your sense of security and well-being in the present moment, the physical and psychological effects of trauma can linger for years and years and years. And that's known as a somatic memory. The word somatic means of the body. So it's probably no surprise that your body, from head to toe, and its sensations, specifically linked to trauma, play a very central role in somatic memories. You can experience things like headaches, heart palpitations, stomach issues, fatigue, dizziness, insomnia, sexual pain. All of these things can be somatic symptoms related to past trauma. When something painful happens to us and we feel intense emotions, the experience is a full body response. Hormones are released, our respiratory and cardiac functions change, and our circulatory systems prepare themselves for action. So when the event challenges our ability to cope, our system can then become overwhelmed. And as a result, the memory is stored in fragments in our brain, but our bodies also carry the memory of that trauma. Now, I've mentioned this word flashbacks a couple times, and I think it's incumbent on me to kind of explain what are flashbacks versus just regular memories, right? So flashbacks occur when something reminds us of an earlier traumatic experience. These reminders are often referred to as triggers, and they can include people, places, things, and they create a response in our bodies and in our brains. We may or may not be aware of the links between the trigger and the response. So don't be surprised if you get confused when you have a flashback. Oftentimes, what we th as therapists do is we try to help you make connections. So, by making that connection, you have an understanding of why a trigger occurred. And that way, it makes sense to you. You don't feel like you're going, as I've heard many clients say, going insane, right? That's not something that I worry about when a person is experiencing a flashback. My concern mainly is to help my client understand that there is a logical reason why this happened, but your logical brain at present is blocked from understanding the logic of the flashback. And so sometimes it might feel like some things are unrelated to what we experienced, and that can cause a flashback, but really, honestly, they remind us of that traumatic event, and so they are connected in that tangential way. And all of these things can cause flashbacks. And flashbacks can also happen without an external reminder. They can actually be results of intrusive thoughts or intrusive emotions that keep coming back to you. So flashbacks are commonly described as re-experiencing the traumatic event through imagery, nightmares, or intrusive memories. Flashbacks can leave you feeling distressed and often do. They occur when something, mainly a trigger, reminds us of past traumatic experiences, and these reminders can be people, places, objects, or even sounds and smells. So then we have flashbacks, and then we have somatic memories that I've mentioned, and we also have emotional memories. So I'm going to briefly go over those as well. So physical memories or flashbacks or somatic flashbacks. Let's see, how do I want to say this? All right, let's just start from the beginning. Okay. So at times, our brains and even our bodies, they struggle with perception of time and reality as it is. And we can feel that we're re-experiencing painful events in the present moment. So past painful events. This full body response will indicate a somatic flashback. So somatic flashbacks can involve an involuntary re-experiencing of past traumatic events, re-experiencing the emotional and physical sensations that we felt during the original event. During a somatic flashback, someone may see complete or partial images from an event, but you're still feeling that physical sensation. The person experiencing the flashback may hear sounds associated with the original event, and they may experience physical sensations that took place, like you could sweat, racing heartbeat, pain in the chest, the arm, the head, the legs, wherever it was. It can be sudden and unexpected when it comes on you. And it can feel in the moment when it happens that the reality of your present moment dissolves in front of you. And like you're suspended in this unreality. Now, emotional memories or flashbacks are reminders of past trauma that can trigger an overwhelming emotional response. Some examples are emotional outbursts such as anger, fear, tears, uncontrolled laughter even. And there may be little recognition between the stimulus and response. And that makes regulating emotional experience flashbacks even harder. And so here's some of the things that emotional flashbacks can involve: an absence of visual or auditory memory, sudden regressions of intense emotions and feelings experienced in the past original event or events, like feelings of helplessness, despair, fear, rage. And often when a person is experiencing emotional flashbacks, we actually type them under a specific classification of PTSD called CPTSD, which the C stands for complex post-traumatic stress disorder. And oftentimes, emotional flashbacks, we find them most often occurring in adults who had trauma before the age of 12. So childhood, adverse childhood experiences, we find most often related to emotional flashbacks. Now, when I finally was in that shower on Jimmy's birthday, and I was having that panic attack, or hyperventilating really, and all the pieces fell into place and I understood what was happening, I sat down in that shower and I grounded myself. I did breathing. I concentrated, like I said earlier, on the water falling on my head. At one point, I was even counting, seeing how many of the drops I could count. And there's a reason for that. I needed to use my skills that I had learned over years and years to ground myself so that I wouldn't be overwhelmed by these somatic experiences. It's possible to do that. And so I want to give you some tips on how to handle somatic experiences or flashbacks if you experience them. And I would be surprised if there was anybody in this world that didn't have this. You know, I've been talking a lot about relating somatic experiences to PTSD. The thing of it is that your body just remembers, period. It remembers when you fell off your bike and scraped your knee. It remembers when you had COVID. It remembers when you, had food poisoning, right? Maybe you ate shrimp and you got food poisoning. Well, your body remembers and tells you not to eat shrimp again, right? It tells you that. Those are all somatic memories. Somatic flashbacks are when they're related to PTSD. But all of that being said, there are still ways to manage these different levels of somatic memories and flashbacks. And so I want to give you a couple tips here. The first step in handling these somatic memories or flashbacks is reassuring yourself that you are in the present moment and that the thing you are experiencing is not happening now. So using grounding techniques can be very helpful and will bring you back to the present. So in my next segment of A Time for Hygge, I'm going to lead you through a grounding exercise. Hopefully it'll be a new one. I can't remember if I've done this one before. But regulating somatic flashbacks require a combination of body-based and cognitive, as in brain-based strategies. So you got to focus on both what the body is experiencing and what the brain is telling you and experiencing. So start with calming the body and then move on to challenging your thinking and reorienting yourself to your present time stamp. Okay? This is all very technical. And if you feel overwhelmed by me just telling you this, my last recommendation on how to handle somatic experiences, I'll give you right now. It was the last thing I was going to tell you, but I'll tell you right now. Go see a mental health therapist. Okay? There's no shame in it. In fact, those of us that are therapists, the very first thing we'll thank you, most of us will thank you for being so brave as to come in and talk to us in the first place. Because holy cow, telling a perfect stranger your most deepest, darkest fears and experiences, how is that not bravery? Give me a break. Anybody who thinks differently, you've obviously not tried it because it is the scariest thing, but it's also the most empowering thing. And therapists can help guide you through learning the best coping skills for you. There are so many coping skills out there, strategies, breathing techniques, grounding techniques, everything out there under the sun. There are so many of them. What works for you is unique. So it might be a mixed bag of things, or it might be all about challenging unwanted thoughts, or it could all be about breathing techniques. I don't know. I can't tell you. Okay. That's what a therapist is there to help work with you on figuring out. Mindfulness is another one. And that was my next, tips. There we go. Handling or cultivating mindfulness, that can help you identify what you're feeling and why. And this is especially useful in the context of emotional flashbacks, where there is no specific memory to clue you into why you're feeling what you're feeling. Okay. Practicing self-talk while you employ other techniques, like reminding yourself that you are safe, that this is not happening right now, this is not real. That's a really good technique. Focusing on your breathing, that's another one. Practicing grounding techniques that work to anchor you in the present. For example, engaging your senses. That's one of my absolute favorite ones. That's actually the one that I did in the shower. Engaging my senses, my five senses. Identify activities and objects or people that make you feel safe. So when something like this happens, you reach out to whatever makes you feel safe. If you really want to get technical, you can track your triggers and patterns by keeping a journal or a diary. I do think there are a couple apps out there that can help you track these types of things. I'm pretty darn sure there's an app out there. There seems to be an app out there for everything. I just don't know about this particular one. So if any of you have any ideas, feel free to message me and let me know, and I can follow up on the next episode. When you have a traumatic experience, I think this is the stupidest thing I wrote, actually. Return gently to your body and the present with slow, deep breathing. I like how pompous I sound there. Return gently to your body. When you're having a traumatic moment, you can't be in the traumatic moment, a flashback, and then all of a sudden, as it's ebbing, think to yourself, I need to return gently to my body, so let's just take some deep breaths. Sorry, that just sounds so pompous, and I wrote it. Oh boy. Okay. I'm gonna move on because I can't even handle myself right now. A lot of therapists will say something like, shake it off, literally. I've done this a couple times, and sometimes it has worked and sometimes it happens. But Peter Levine, he wrote a book called Waking the Tiger, and he explains that there's a connection between stress and release in the natural world, as in the animal kingdom, and what we as humans experience in trauma and recovery. And so he talks about how if we kind of take on some animal characteristics, as in when we experience a somatic or flashback, if we literally shake it off, you can release that feeling and the stress related to that memory or flashback, and you can move on to coming back to normal life. I don't know how helpful that one's been for me. I can't really say, but it is a technique that's out there. So give it a whirl if you'd like. Another one, back to the tracking idea, identifying your external triggers and learn to cope ahead of time. So when I lived in Portland, I could not go to certain areas of Portland because it triggered traumatic memories. And I knew that about myself. So I didn't go there. And that was me coping ahead, being aware of the things that I could and could not handle, and making preparation and safeguards to protect myself from those. And that is perfectly fine. It's when it becomes unhealthy that we have to take a look at it. So if you'd like me to go into when it becomes unhealthy, I can do that on another episode. And again, like I said at the beginning, my very last and most important tip is to work through your trauma with a trauma therapist. Most therapists these days are trauma therapists. We all take at least a little bit of training, if not go into a deep dive like I've done, of what trauma is, what it looks like both in childhood and in adulthood, the different types of therapy modalities used. I've used many things with my clients. Cognitive processing technique is one that's very popular with vets or men returning from war. I don't use that so much because my experience with working with people has been more from childhood trauma being re-experienced in adulthood. And so I've worked through a lot of that with people. But that, my friends, is the somatic memories that I wanted to talk about. How am I dealing with that now? I'm journaling a lot. And it's hard for me to write because it's hard for me to hold a pen. But every night I'm trying to write a paragraph. That's all I'm asking of myself. Just a little paragraph of what I'm experiencing now. There's two things I could do with that when I feel like I've purged it all from my body. I could rip it up, I could burn it, I could throw it to the wind, or I could save it to remind myself when and if it happens again, that I'm not crazy. There's a pattern here. There's a reason why this is happening. I'm of two minds of it. It's very therapeutic to rip things up, burn them. I've done that in the past, and it's felt so freaking good to do that, to get rid of it, to purge it. But then there's been times where I've longed to have those pieces of paper back so I could reread those things and remember what that was, because I'm experiencing something similar again and I needed to remember what in the world it meant to me, why it was happening, and maybe what I did to help reground myself from that, right? There's so much we can do. But I hope that this was helpful to you. If it triggered some thoughts or emotions or concerns in yourself, please reach out to a therapist. If you don't feel like reaching out to a therapist is wise for you at this time, who in your life is your safe person that you can tell anything to and they would love you regardless? And now let's take it one step further. Who Is there anybody in your life that you could tell things to and they wouldn't judge you or try to fix the situation as you presented it to them? If you can't think of a single person in your life that can listen to your struggles and not try to tell you how to fix it, then I want you to reevaluate if seeking out a therapist is right for you. A therapist's job is not to fix your situation. It's to walk beside you and help you understand how you unbreak the cycle of trauma in your life, how you heal from the past, and how you make a healthy future and present moment for yourself. We are not here to solve your problems. Okay? Thank you, my friends. And that is personal skill set. A time for Hygge. So I realized after I did my last little segment of somatic memories and flashbacks that I've already done a really in-depth grounding exercise with you guys. So I changed my plans. I'm going to do a really simple one that's more about focusing your mind than it is about grounding yourself in the moment. So I'd like to invite you to go ahead and find yourself a nice, comfortable seated position in your favorite room in the house. Okay? The room that you're most comfortable in. And I'd like you to go ahead and take a deep breath and sit back. We're going to start by breathing in through our nose and out through our mouth. This breathing is to focus your breathing, not to expand your breathing or to make you, you know, expel all of the breath out of your lungs or fill your lungs to capacity. It's just about focusing your breath and allowing your mind to rest. So breathing in through the nose and out through the mouth. Now, as your eyes are closed and you're continuing your breathing, I want you to picture your favorite color, whatever that might be. Get it nice and strong in your mind as you continue to breathe in through the nose and out through the mouth. And on the count of three, I'm going to invite you to open your eyes and name three things in your space that are the color you're picturing in your mind's eye. Okay? One more time, breathe in through the mouth, the nose, and out through the mouth. One, two, three. Open your eyes, and I'll give you a moment to name three things that are your favorite color in this, from the space around you. Very good. All right, now I'm going to invite you to go ahead and close your eyes again and continue that breathing in through your nose and out through your mouth. And as you relax, then invite you to picture your second favorite color. If you can't think of your second favorite color, think of a color that pleases you. On the count of three, I'm going to invite you to open your eyes and now name five things when you open your eyes that are that color that you've been picturing. One, two, three. Five things that are the color you pictured just now. All right, now I want you to congratulate yourself. You just focused
You practice a breathing technique. You recognized A, colors that please you or are your favorite colors. B, you recognize that you have surrounded yourself with those colors, and hopefully those things will bring you comfort and joy. C, you focused your mind and your energy in this moment, not only on the breathing, but on naming and finding things that are those colors. And this is a pretty simple technique. I especially use this with people who have high anxiety and tell me that their mind races a lot. This is also really good for people who have PTSD or who have flashbacks, because again, this reorients you to the present moment, to your surroundings. It helps you to calm down those racing thoughts, those anxious feelings, focuses you on your breath. And this might happen to you. It doesn't happen to everybody, but for me, when I do this, especially when I have headaches, because when I get really highly emotional, I get really tense neck, and then I get a really bad headache. So this technique usually, and I even did it this time, and I'm not even feeling tense right now, but I feel like all the muscles in my forehead and around my eyes, they just started tingling and relaxing a bit. And that to me, in and of itself, is worth doing this exercise because it helps relieve those emotional backlash headaches. So I hope you can take this time to be in the moment. Sometimes I wonder if you guys feel like maybe my time for Hygge moments are truly along the Hygge lines, and really, I take this time and this segment to, do some reminders about the Hygge lifestyle, which is to bring you comfort, joy, peace, happiness. But, that can look like a myriad of things and can be not just about indulging in a moment of a hot cup of tea, cuddled up with a blanket, or a nice big slice of chocolate gooey cake, but it can be other things that are very much focused around mindfulness and mental health. So I thank you guys for coming along with me on this Hygge moment, and I hope this was helpful. Contemplation Corner. Today's quote is by Bessel van der Kolk. He is the author of The Body Keeps the Score. He is one of my favorite neurologists, psychologists. He is just masterful. He can be kind of abrasive, but at the same time, he tells things in such a way, like he doesn't sugarcoat things. And this quote is along those lines. He's not sugarcoating anything for you. And he talks, if you want to learn really in depth about somatic memories and about your body keeping the score, if you will, the memories of the things that happen to you, I would highly recommend this book. I think probably what I would recommend first off is if you feel like you might be sensitive to this, that maybe listening to the audiobook the first time instead of reading it might be a wiser course of action, because oftentimes when we're listening to an audiobook, our mind will wander, and that lessens the impact of the words that we're listening to. So whereas when we're reading, we're oftentimes concentrating really hard, we're becoming engrossed in something, and something can hit us especially deeply, and it might be kind of more of a traumatic experience when you're reading something like this. So take that with a grain of salt, but do whatever you want. If you want to read it, I highly recommend it. If you don't, go ahead and leave it on the shelf. It's okay. So the quote is, "Traumatized people chronically feel unsafe inside their bodies. The past is alive in the form of gnawing interior discomfort. Their bodies are constantly bombarded by visceral warning signs, and in an attempt to control these processes, they often become expert at ignoring their gut feelings and in numbing awareness of what is played out inside. They learn to hide from themselves." Bessel van der Kolk. from the book The Body Keeps the Score. Well, my friends, our time together has come to a close for another episode. Thank you so much for joining me. I had a marvelous time relaying to you my perspective around somatic memories, but also like sharing with you my exciting news that I picked up my knitting needles again, and it feels so good. I hope that you are crafting what you love and that you love what you craft. And until next time, just be well and ta-ta for now.